congregation said, amen. Amen. I read somewhere a long time ago, and I become more and more convinced of it as time goes on, that you become like the God that you serve. I believe there's lots and lots of wisdom in that. I've had lots of people over the years tell me, I don't serve the same God you do. And there's a sense in which we have an understanding and a picture of God, each one of us. And I suppose to some degree, each one of our God, at least our understanding of God, is a little bit different. But there is but one God, and He is who He is. And our responsibility is let Him be that. It's really wise of us not to try to create our own God. Back in Exodus, when God was forming a people for Himself, you know what the most fundamental and essential need that they had was? They needed to know God. They needed to know who God was. They needed to learn some things about God in such an impressive way that they would always revere Him and be ever afraid to make Him angry. That's not the way that we like to talk about God today. But God, wanting to make a very deep, lifelong impression on these people, brought them to a mountain. And He told them to wash their clothes and to assemble around the base of the mountain when they had washed their clothes. And he said, if any living creature or person touches this mountain, you'll die. And then He came down from heaven, and He set it on fire. And He spoke to them. In Elton's class this morning, he used this same section of Scripture. Do you know what the very first words were that God said directly to the people? He said, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt and out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods beside me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or in the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses His name. You remember how the people reacted when He finished? When the people saw the thunder and lightning and heard the trumpet and saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance, and they said to Moses, speak to us yourself and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us or we will die. God made an impression on them that day, didn't He? I wish we could say that that impression lasted as God intended for the rest of their life. But unfortunately, it didn't last too long, as a matter of fact, did it? But I look back and I think about how God was forming for Himself this nation of people, and how that they needed an organization to be a people. They needed a head. They needed a leader. They needed laws. And He brought them out into a desert place, away from everyone and everything else, so that there would be no distractions. And He fed them every day, and He gave them water every day, and they didn't have to worry about going shopping for clothes or for shoes. And they didn't have to worry about any of those things. They could just simply concentrate on the lessons that God had for them. And one of the primary lessons that God had, in fact, the lesson that He had for them in various ways, was to teach them about Himself. And why do you suppose that God used such? And it will say that God's voice got louder and louder and louder as he spoke to them, so that they were trembling with fear. Why do you think that God used such harsh language and such harsh methodology on that occasion? Well, it provides a basis for our relationship with God. There are some things about God that we tend to, given a choice, just kind of push aside. But God doesn't want anything about his character pushed aside. What was the first commandment? Have no other gods beside me. What was the second commandment? Don't make any kind of an idol or any image of anything in the sky or the earth or the water or the depth, the deep, under the earth, anywhere. Don't make any kind of an icon. Don't make any kind of an image. And I'd like to look at those two things, and maybe from a practical, what I believe a practical standpoint and an applicable for us today. Why is it so important to God that you have no other gods? Well, he said, I'm a jealous God, didn't he? But why is that so very important to God? You see, these people, their background was that they had been born and lived and grown up in Egypt, and Egypt had many gods. And when God came to release his people, there was a battle of gods. God took on all of Egypt's gods, every one of them. And every plague was an attack against some god that the Egyptians worshipped. And whenever it was all over, and when Egypt was left in utter ruins, what had been proven? Well, God said, I want the Egyptians to know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand upon Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. Exodus chapter 7, verse 5. And so whenever these people left Egypt, the Egyptians knew what? Their God's stronger than our God. Our gods are left in shambles. Our gods had no force against this God. And you know who else knew it? The people themselves, the Israelites. They knew it also, didn't they? And particularly after they had left the Red Sea incident, right? You know, the Bible has some rather funny stories. They're funny to us because they didn't attack our gods, but has some rather funny, humorous stories about idols. In the days of the judges, Eli had just died. Samuel was a young man in 1 Samuel chapter 5. The Ark of the Covenant had been captured by the Philistines and had been taken. They took it to the house of the chief Philistine god, Dagon. And they took it as a trophy to show that Dagon was more powerful than the god of these Israelites, because they had defeated him in battle, and it was obvious to everyone that Dagon was the more powerful of the two gods. But God had other plans, and God has what appears to me to be something of a sense of humor, because the next morning, whenever Dagon priests came in to light the fires and get everything going, whatever they did in the morning, they found Dagon, their large idol of Dagon, was laid face down in front of the Ark of the Covenant. And so they hurried and picked their god up, and they put him back on his pedestal and put him back in his place. And the next morning when they came in, guess what was what they saw? Not only was Dagon face down in front of the Ark of the Covenant again, but his head and his hands were dismembered. God has kind of a sense of humor, doesn't he? What'd that prove? It proved that God doesn't need anybody to defend him. God's perfectly capable of taking care of himself. It proved that God is the one God. And that you would make a mistake whenever you make a decision that there is someone or some other God or something that can replace God or be more powerful than God. You also remember the story of Elijah and the Baal prophets. There were a total of 850 Baal prophets and prophets of the grove in 1 Kings chapter 18. And it came time for the showdown at the corral here. And you remember the scene whenever Elijah came time for him to offer his sacrifice to prove which God was the most powerful. He built this altar and he put stones and he had the wood and he slaughtered the ox and he had them bring. And this has always been some irony here because they were on top of Mount Carmel. And he had them pour out four barrels of water over this whole scene here and dig a ditch around the altar. And then he said, well, that might not be enough. Go get four more barrels. And so they got four more barrels and they poured four more. And he said, well, just to make sure that there's no doubt about it, we want to fill the trench up and everything completely saturated. Go get four more barrels. Now, that becomes a little bit interesting when you realize that they were in the middle of a drought, by the way, that had become really, really severe. And those guys who had to go get that water and tote it up the hill and these barrels of water, I suspect that was pretty interesting to all the people around as they were pouring that water out on the ground. And after it was all over and you look back at it and you ask the question, why didn't Baal answer whenever they cried out to him and they cut themselves and they did everything they could to try to make Baal answer? The answer in verse 29 says, 1 Kings 18, but there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. And you know why, and I know why. Because Baal was no God. Because Baal couldn't do anything. He was just like Dagon. He had no power. He was a man-made God. And you think, how stupid is it? And I use that word advisedly, but how stupid is it to serve a God who does not exist? And God asked that question over and over and over in the prophets in many, many different ways. There is only one God, and it's really important that we don't forget that. And you think, well, you're preaching to the choir. Why would you be preaching something like that to Christians? We all know there's one God. Well, why is it important? I want to take this to the next step here and tie it in together. Why is it important to God that there be no idols, that you don't make any kind of an image of anything in the sky or on the earth or in the water or underneath the ground, that you don't make any kind of an image of anything that would represent Him? Why is that so important to God? Well, first of all, what does God look like? No man has seen God. God is spirit. So you can't see God. So you don't know what to make to represent God. But there are some other reasons. Because man is made in God's image, making an idol is an attempt by man to make God into his image. And also, there's nothing in the world that can adequately represent God. And every attempt that you would make to make any kind of an idol falls short. And you become a child of a lesser God. Your God is too small. Anything that you could possibly, you can't conceive of anything big enough. He created it all. And even you remember when Solomon finished the temple and he was praying, then he reminded all the people in his prayer, we know that the God who made the heavens and everything that exists cannot be confined to any temple, even if it's as grand a temple as we just made. Any attempt that we might make to make an idol comes up with a God who's too small. And then And I think we have levels of importance here. All of these things are really important about why God would insist. He knows man. He knows us. He knows what we do. He knows how we think. An idol can be worshipped without changing your life. You stop and think about that a minute. An idol can be worshipped without changing your life, but you have to be holy to worship God. God repeatedly says, "Be ye holy." Why? For I am holy. We come to the New Testament, Romans chapter 12, verse 1, present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God. Why do you think God required the Israelites to wash their clothes before they approached the mountain? Why was that important to God? He's teaching them something. You don't come into my presence with filth. You come clean. You make your life holy. You don't drag your pet sins into my presence. God is a holy God. And he sent his son to die to purchase a holy people. There are consequences of serving idols. And now I want to make a little bit of a transition, because as we think about, and as God was talking about making idols, we're talking about something physical that people can see. But it's also possible to make an idol in the form of, in your mind, you have a God. You might think you have Jehovah God, but you have a God that you've not let be big enough in your mind, and you serve a God that's too small. Then you have, in essence, made an idol in your own heart. And you're serving a different God. You're serving a lesser God. And for many folks, it is that we serve a God who's not so righteous. That may be the most common mistake of all. By definition, an idol is a man-made god. And when man makes his god, man gets to make his god's character. And I have had, and I'm sure that you have also, in some instances it was from people who really broke my heart, who said, "My God wouldn't do," and you fill in the blank. "My God doesn't," and you fill in the blank. You see, by their own admission, we've created our own God. I have my God, you have your God. And that really makes things comfortable. Because I can take my road, you can take your road, you can believe what you want to, I can believe what I want to, you don't condemn me, I won't condemn you, and we'll all be fine and we'll live in harmony together. Do you think that man will make a God who is holy and righteous? Do you think that man, when he makes his own God, will make a God who demands that he is righteous? He won't do it. Or will he make a God who will allow him to have a little bit of sin? Remember that first idol that Israel had? That golden calf? Remember Mount Sinai? You remember how they were worshiping their God? They were being sexually immoral. You see any irony here? When man makes a God, we get to make his character. We get to decide how he's worshipped. We get to be the one who decides how I approach him. We become like our God. We really, really do become like our God. In Romans chapter 1, if you remember our study, and that's exactly where idolatry ultimately leads. You remember, though, that sequential departure? That man is thankless, and then ultimately he brings God down, he begins to worship and serve created things rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. And then the next thing it will say, they begin to dishonor their bodies between themselves. Men doing things with men that are unseemly. It always is going to lead there. Making an idol. It may not lead there today. It may not lead there in your life, but it's going to lead there in somebody's life as you hand that God down. Because that's where it ultimately goes. You know, one of the major differences between that happens to us when we become a Christian, rather than making the comparison, let me just say, one of the major steps, one of the major decisions that we make in becoming a Christian is, I don't like being told what to do. You know what I'm saying? Not many of us do. But when we become a Christian, we make a decision that we're going to let God tell us what to do. Really. That's a significant decision that we make in our life. We're not going to follow our own desires anymore. We're not going to be calling the shots in our life anymore. Somebody else is going to be calling the shots. And that God better be a pretty big God. He better be big enough. And it better be true enough, if I'm going to let Him direct my life and let Him call the shots and let Him make decisions in my life, then it needs to be the right God. I like to decide for myself what's right and what's wrong. But as a Christian, I let God decide that. And there are some things that just don't seem to be all that harmful to me that God despises. And I make a decision every day. Am I going to follow what I want to do, my decision, my wisdom, what I want, what I think is right and wrong, or am I going to let God decide that? You know what the most fundamental, essential need that God's people have today is? It's exactly the same one that those Israelites needed when they came out of Egypt. We need to know God. We really, really need to know God. Some of us have lived with our picture, inaccurate picture of God for so long that it doesn't even occur to us that we might not be serving the one true God. We may not have an accurate picture of God. And you see, that's an idol when we create our own God. And when we start talking about my God won't do this, my God doesn't send anybody to hell. How many times have you heard somebody say that? Now, by the way, I have to tell you, I agree with that, okay? I don't believe God sends anybody to hell. I believe you make that choice yourself. Every one of us makes a decision. Will I serve and obey God, or will I make my own God? And we might not do it consciously. We might do it subconsciously. I have been in a situation, probably you have too, where I have seen people literally bow down to an idol. And it makes my stomach hurt. It makes my heart hurt. To see an old woman in Europe come up to an idol, and she obviously has arthritis and she's in pain, and she gets down on her knees and she gets down on her hands in front of an idol. And it just makes my heart hurt. That she's obviously sincere. But God said, don't make any kind of an idol. Don't worship and serve anyone but me. But it's just as sad to see people who are bent on justifying themselves while practicing sin, who come into God's presence with dirty clothes, as it were. And then, one verse, I'm going to leave it with you. And this verse just really stuck out when I read it the other day, ran across it. In fact, it's kind of the reason behind this whole lesson. And it's in an interesting place. It's in Jonah 2:8. And it says, those who hold to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. Those that hold to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. I love my God. Don't you? God. But He's also a righteous God. And you don't get to pick and choose. You don't get to pick the parts of Him that you like and put them together and construct your own God. God said, I am who I am. And it's our task in our life to learn who the great I am is and to worship and serve our one true God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. Let's stand and sing.